The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Welcome to Deep Dive with the Institute for Justice. My name is Melanie Hildreth, and I'm here with IJ Senior Attorneys Paul Sherman and Bob McNamara. Today, we're going to do a deep dive into amicus briefs, what they are, where they came from, and how IJ and others use them to change the law. Paul and Bob, when we were talking about the content for today's show, I will confess that I was a little surprised at how much there is to say about amicus briefs. But to get us started, can you explain for the non-lawyers in the audience, what is an amicus brief and where did they come from?
Absolutely. I was told that this podcast was our opportunity to get nerdy, so we're going to get nerdy. So amicus briefs come from the phrase amicus curiae, which is Latin for friend of the court. And it's a term that dates back actually to Roman law, where the friend of the court was literally a friend of the court. It was a guy who would sit in the court and knew a lot about the law and could say things like, oh, 10 years ago, there was a case about this. Did you guys know that? Or if a litigant didn't show up or somebody died, the court could say, you know, Claudius, can you just make that argument for us? And it evolved over time to take account for the fact that while the legal system is set up as a dispute between two people, it's kind of a duel, a trial by combat between two people, court cases actually affect the rights of a lot more people. And courts at common law were very unwilling just to let people show up and interfere in what was supposed to be a lawsuit between person A and person B. But person C frequently had something to say, and so that person would appoint themselves as a friend of the court, not really out of concern for the court, but to advance their own interests. Like there's a famous 18th century case in England where there was a lawsuit for a contract, and someone sued a woman to enforce this contract, and the woman's defense was she was married, and married women weren't allowed to form contracts. And during the court case, this guy shows up as amicus curiae, and he says, I'm the guy she says she was married to, and we totally weren't married. I'm married to someone else. She's just trying to embarrass me by getting the court to say we were married. And it's sort of the classic example. It's a lesson, actually, that the world has always been as weird as it is now. But it's an example of how people who are strangers to the lawsuit have kind of a lot of things to say about the lawsuit, and lawsuits can affect their rights, too. And in modern times, that's evolved from this woman is trying to pretend I'm married to her to I have kind of broader concerns. I have ideological concerns. I have concerns about the law or the Constitution and concerns of the sort of ideological nature that IJ brings to bear.
Yeah, and one of the things that you'll see sometimes is the parties to the actual dispute will have a very narrow interest in the way the thing is resolved. And sometimes they want it resolved in a way that is overall not good for society. And so one of the roles that amici play, amici being the plural of amicus.
Way to be nerdy.
Yeah, I know. So one of the roles that amici play is providing that broader perspective so that courts don't get overly focused on just the narrow dispute that's before them.
So are there examples, maybe not quite as ancient and niche as the woman saying that the guy was married to her and he wasn't actually married to her, of amicus briefs being used really well, where they did broaden out the issues for the court and help have a better impact than maybe the parties would have had without them?
Yeah, I mean, I think historically, as with a lot of things in public interest law, the primary historical example goes back to the NAACP and the NAACP's crusade against legal segregation. That was a lot of direct litigation, but it was also a lot of amicus briefs presenting social science research to the courts about what segregation was, about the effects of segregation, and trying to broaden the court's perspective. And that is a tack that IJ has taken as well. We try to use our amicus briefs in order to provide useful information to the courts and sort of let the courts know about the context in which they're making these decisions so that they hopefully don't go down the wrong path that litigants sometimes want. I mean, just this past term, you'll frequently see cases where there's a lawyer who has a particular interest for their client. This comes up frequently in criminal defense cases. Someone's been charged with a crime. They have a criminal defense lawyer, and correctly, that criminal defense lawyer wants to get the guy off. That's their job. But the case can turn on important constitutional issues. This past term, there was a case about the non-delegation doctrine, which is this important doctrine about when Congress can give administrative agencies or give the executive branch the power to make their own law. And it came up in the context of a criminal case where the defendant was frankly represented by people who were not that excited about the non-delegation doctrine. They didn't get into criminal defense to, championed the non-delegation doctrine. They probably disagreed with the non-delegation doctrine. But it was the central issue in the case. And the important thing that IJ, for example, could do in that case was come in and say, we don't have a horse in this guy's criminal dispute, but we do have broader interests in the constitutional theory here. And let us tell you how the non-delegation doctrine has worked in the states. Let us tell you about how this has actually played out and give you some examples you can use that probably won't come up in the party's briefs, but go directly to the legal issue you're actually considering.
Yeah, this is also something we do a lot in our eminent domain cases, where we have this broad nationwide expertise on eminent domain issues. And people like Bob have a comprehensive knowledge of the way, for example, post-Kelo litigation has played out in the states. And so when a dispute comes up in one state, they can say, well, this is the way that essentially every other state has approached it. And courts can find that extremely helpful.
Now, I was promised an anecdote about bigamy, and I don't know what the anecdote is. So, can you introduce? I don't know how to introduce it. Can you bring it on?
The bigamy anecdote is the famous 18th century English case. Defendant in that case.
So she was married to somebody else, not the other guy.
She was originally married to, so the guy who came in as the amicus and said we weren't married actually was married to that woman. His marriage was annulled because she had previously been married to yet another guy. And so that marriage was invalid. And then the second husband went and married someone else, and him marrying someone else so infuriated this woman that she recruited a fifth guy. She had a lot of male friends. She recruited a fifth guy to sue her for a contract so that she could get a court
just
to say she was married to the second guy.
We're going
to
get Mark to insert a flow chart so that the viewers can understand what just happened.
I have some slides at home.
Yeah, fantastic.
So I took us to the important amicus briefs and then back to the less so. But yeah, that is a pretty outrageous story.
Well, if we want to talk about interesting historical amicus briefs, we can also talk about Louis Brandeis's brief in 1908 in Mueller versus Oregon, which is probably the most famous amicus brief in American law and really set the stage for the way a lot of people approach writing amicus briefs today. So Mueller versus Oregon was a case about a maximum hours law for women. And before that time, most amicus briefs had been, as Bob was suggesting, these kind of surveys of just the law. What made Louis Brandeis's brief different was that it was essentially a massive collection of social science evidence with really only like 2 pages of legal analysis and then 98 pages of social science evidence that he had cobbled together. And it ended up having an influence. The court upheld the maximum hours law. Sort of ironically, a lot of the social science evidence in that case was absolute junk about how women are enfeebled and can't work more than these certain amount of hours. But for better or worse, that has set the stage for people to bring in good social science evidence in future cases.
Now, I suspect that courts they probably still get some junk. Is that one of the challenges that they face with, maybe the quality and the quantity of amicus that they have to deal with is sorting through it? Because if you get a lot of social science and you're not a scientist, how is a court supposed to make something of that?
Well, and not just you get a lot of social science, but you get just a lot of input. At the beginning of the 20th century, most Supreme Court cases proceeded without any amicus briefs at all. And today, there's almost no Supreme Court case that proceeds without at least one amicus brief. Every case before the court draws amici and usually multiple amici. And in high profile cases, you can see dozens upon dozens of briefs.
Yeah, 50, 60, 70 in some cases.
To the point where, some people joke that the term friend of the court is no longer appropriate, that these people are really enemies of the court. They're showing up without anything new to say and just making the judges read more. And so there is a challenge for the courts in kind of sifting through what these briefs are, and there's a challenge for people filing the briefs to make sure that they're doing so for a good reason, that they're actually providing something useful and sort of creating a reputation with the courts that I don't always show up, but when I show up, I have something to say that you can use. You should read my brief because I'm thinking about the court. I'm not thinking about myself or I'm not thinking about the process wrong. You frequently see people treat amicus briefs almost as if you get a vote. We at IJ regularly get requests from other people to file amicus briefs in cases, and I'll hear from a lawyer asking, we'd love to have IJ file a brief in support in this case. And the case doesn't really have anything to do with what IJ does. And I'll ask, what did you think I would say in this brief? And the lawyer just says, well, I thought you would say we would win. As if the court is just going to kind of count noses and say, oh, Bob McNamara votes this way, and somebody else votes that way. And that's not really how judicial decision making works. And so kind of the hallmarks, the things we try to avoid in IJ litigation or in IJ's amicus brief program are sort of briefs that take the vote counting approach where we're just filing to sort of assert that we support a position as if we get a vote, as if constitutional law is a purely democratic process.
Or as if the brief is a press release.
Right. And we try to avoid briefs that are really mostly about us instead of mostly about the court. There are a lot of people who like to file briefs in order to say they filed a brief. And that's why in these cases you see 50 or 100 briefs. In a case that's about an abstruse actual legal issue, you might see 3 or 4 from people who are interested in the law. When a case is about gay marriage, you will see 50, 60 on each side of the issue. And many of them, to be frank, are just people who want to say they were heard and people want to say they filed a brief. And they say they make arguments that aren't any different from the arguments the parties are making. They're not adding anything to the process.
Or sometimes they make arguments that are just absolutely bananas. I mean, that's an actual problem in some of these high profile cases before the Supreme Court is, you know, to file an amicus brief in the Supreme Court, you have to be a member of the Supreme Court bar. But that really just means that you have to have been practicing law for 5 years and have a couple people sponsor your membership. And so there are briefs that get filed that have pictures of cartoon cats in them in a recent case.
That is literally true.
That's a it
wasn't even a meme. There was an extended discussion in that brief. It was a case about gay marriage, and the brief just goes on this bizarre tangent about whether this 1980s Hanna-Barbera character was secretly gay, with a picture of the cartoon character in the middle of the brief. And it's bonkers. And you just people spend money on these things. And so it's very much the hallmark of IJ's amicus program that we actually prefer not to file amicus briefs. We don't consider filing the amicus brief itself an accomplishment. We try to measure or try to look for whether the amicus brief is actually successful, whether we are persuading the court, whether our arguments are getting picked up, not just whether the side we supported won, but whether we're making an argument that is picked up by someone writing for the court, whether they're citing our brief or whether they're citing the same cases we cite. Our goal is to move the law. And if we don't think we have a path to move the law, we would rather not file the brief. There's actually a very strong bias against amicus briefs at IJ. And Dana Berliner, our litigation director, his mantra kind of is we're supposed to be doing litigation. We're supposed to be suing the government. If we're going to file an amicus brief, if we're going to participate in someone else's lawsuit, it should be high value. There's a presumption against doing it unless you can make the case that you have a real strategic value that you're going to add in that case.
So one of the things that you can do is sign on to someone else's brief to the extent that people are going to continue to want to put a mark in the sand that this was an issue that they were heard about. Is that maybe a more productive way to do that? Or is it really better for people just to recognize that they have nothing to offer and maybe just sit out more cases than they currently are willing to do?
Signing on to group briefs can be a way to signal to the court that, for example, there is a cross-ideological alliance on a certain point. But it's also the reality that an amicus brief that has 50 signatories is not that much different from an amicus brief that has 49 signatories. Or you'll see amicus briefs where they recruit hundreds of signatories. And it just, the court's going to read the arguments. The court's not going to say, oh, 401 people signed this brief, and so this must be correct. And so there's certainly a point of diminishing returns and things like that. I wouldn't say that they're never useful, and they can send an important signal.
Has to be the reason to do it, is to send that signal as opposed to just turning it in.
And you have to have a reason why sending that signal is important. Like, as for example, there was a case in Texas where we filed an amicus brief recently where the Texas Supreme Court had not yet granted review. And when you talk to law clerks and when you talk to people who've been on the inside of the process, one place amicus briefs can really add value is by signaling that a case is important, that people are watching this, that this isn't just someone trying to advance their own private interests, because every litigant wants to win. And so every litigant has an incentive to say, my case is important, you should take my case. an amicus brief coming in when a court has yet to decide to hear a case, whether it's the U.S. Supreme Court or a state Supreme Court, is a useful way to say this isn't just the litigant wanting to kind of get theirs back. We're just interested in the law, and we can tell you this case is important, and let us tell you why. And that is where a brief from a group like IJ or a brief from the Chamber of Commerce or one of these briefs that is signed by an ideologically diverse coalition can actually be a useful signal. Like, we don't have a stake in this case, but we think this issue is important. And that signals to mostly to the clerks, but also sometimes to the judges or the justices, that this is an issue that a lot of people are watching that maybe you should take to resolve this important question.
Yeah. So at the Supreme Court stage, briefs in support of Supreme Court review are much less common than briefs on the merits. And the job of the clerks is not an easy one. They get 7,000 petitions a year. They grant about 70 cases. So if a case attracts a lot of amicus support at the point where the court's deciding whether to take it, that really can be a valuable signal to the clerks. It helps, I mean, essentially it helps them triage the many, many, many non-meritorious requests that are being filed with the court.
So we've talked a little bit about the reasons, you know, how thoughtful IJ is about whether we take a case, the reasons we might not take a case. I'd like to talk a little bit about when we do take on an amicus brief or agree to play that role. You mentioned that we do it very infrequently. We have about 60 active cases right now. In the last year, we did 12 amicus briefs. So what was it about those opportunities that made them something that we decided, you know, given all of the other things on our plate, this is worth adding?
I think there are a few different things that we consider. One is just institutional expertise. Is this an area where we're doing a lot of litigation and where it's very important to us institutionally that the court announce the correct broader rules of law? And so this is something that we do a lot with our occupational speech litigation, where IJ has helped to pioneer this area of law. We have an extremely well thought out legal theory, and we want to make sure that the courts that are deciding these cases aren't falling into misunderstandings of the law from the fact that the lawyers who are litigating the cases simply know less about this area than we do. Another thing that we do when we're trying to decide whether to take an amicus brief is, do we have some kind of strategic research expertise? So we have a wonderful strategic research team that has done groundbreaking studies on things like campaign finance and civil forfeiture. We've collected a lot of tremendously valuable data, and that data can help inform the courts.
And actually, I think occupational speech is probably the best example, or at least the best recent example, of a strategic amicus campaign we've undertaken. We do a lot of litigation in the area of occupational speech, and occupational speech is, of course, IJ's effort to ensure that the First Amendment protects people who talk for a living, and that the government can't use economic regulations to squelch speech just because people are getting paid while they talk. It's an important constitutional issue. It's something we've been litigating for over a decade and developing a lot of expertise in. And we had kind of our suite of cases, but we weren't the only people litigating cases that raised these issues. And so several years ago in 2014, I think, there was a case in the Ninth Circuit that Paul and I actually listened to the oral argument. And it was just very clear the judges were asking very good questions, and they were not getting what we believed to be the correct answers.
From either side?
No. I mean, the judges were clearly interested in the issue. They realized they kind of had something there that could be hard.
In that compensation for speech,
right,
changing
in kind
the value
of,
what, of the
how the First Amendment applies in the context of, say, licensed professionals. What does the First Amendment mean if all the licensed professional is doing is talking? This was a case brought by psychologists about psychology regulation, and the court was asking very good questions, and the answers were just, again, wrong. And, you know, with all respect to those lawyers, they may have thought about it less than we had thought about it. They may just disagree with us about what the law is, but they weren't saying the things that Paul and I would say, and we were shouting at the recording of the oral argument. And so we wrote an op-ed about it, trying to kind of answer those questions for the court. And when the opinion came out, the plaintiffs...
Terrible.
It just completely ignored the relevant issues, and in fairness to the judges, it ignored those issues because they weren't presented. And the plaintiffs asked the entire Ninth Circuit to rehear the case en banc. And we, with maybe a 2-week window to turn around the brief, jumped in and said, you know, look, the reason to rehear this case is that it completely ignores controlling Supreme Court precedent that tells you, in our view, how to resolve these questions. We have a very simple theory. It's very straightforward. And the first question you have to ask is whether the government is regulating speech, whether it's regulating conduct, and if the only thing people are doing is talking, the government is regulating speech. It's a simple question. And we filed that brief, and the Ninth Circuit didn't rehear the case, but what happened is Judge O'Scanlan on the Ninth Circuit issued a dissenting opinion saying the Ninth Circuit should rehear this case, basically making exactly the argument we made in our brief. And the argument in our brief was, we're not saying these guys win. We're not saying how this case comes out. We don't care how this case comes out. We care how the First Amendment works. And if all you're doing is talking, you're protected by the First Amendment. And Judge O'Scanlan's dissent said, I don't know how this case comes out. I don't care how this case comes out, but it seems to me under this Supreme Court case that IJ is relying on, if all you're doing is talking, the First Amendment applies. And that is, in many ways, the highest value payoff you can have for an amicus brief. We weren't directly cited in the opinion, but it essentially transformed the debate from Bob and Paul say this to Judge O'Scanlan of the Ninth Circuit says this. And so instead of just us making assertions about what the Supreme Court has said, we now had a judicial opinion that was our legal theory, written by an Article III judge.
Yeah, and it shows sort of how we're able to play the long game, because essentially an identical legal issue came up in the Third Circuit. And when it came up there, we did not file a brief in that case. But the court looked to Judge O'Scanlan's dissent in the Ninth Circuit, and it adopted his legal theory. So the legal theory that kind of Bob and I helped to develop was persuasive to Judge O'Scanlan, and then that was persuasive and became the law in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, and you know, subsequently has essentially become the law of the land since the Supreme Court's decision last term in NIFLA versus Becerra.
Which is another example of IJ's amicus program. We continued litigating these occupational speech cases, and kind of the question in these cases was whether there's an exception to the First Amendment for what the courts were calling professional speech. If you're speaking for a living, you're a professional speaker, and maybe the First Amendment applies differently. And that's what we were pushing back against. And this NIFLA v. Becerra decision opinion came, or case rather, came about, and it presented this issue squarely, whether there was a professional speech exception to the First Amendment. And IJ had been litigating this issue in the lower courts for years, and we didn't have a direct stake in, again, the plaintiffs in that case, but we could provide the court not just with our legal expertise, but with our practical expertise. And we filed a brief that said, look, you're being asked to accept this exception to the First Amendment. Let us tell you how this is actually working in practice, because the lower courts had gone nuts with the professional speech exception. There was
in the sense that they were all over the place, or in the sense that they were just applying it willy-nilly to
both? So the thing we kept coming back to, and kind of the most egregious example, is the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals had held that the professional speech exception, and the theory of the professional speech exception is lawyers and doctors kind of have such gravitas that, you know, we can't protect their speech, because essentially a patient or a client just gives themselves over to the lawyer or the doctor, and it's not really speech. They're just in control of you when your lawyer tells you something. And it had been applied to doctors and to lawyers, and there was a Fourth Circuit opinion extending it to fortune tellers. Fortune tellers were not protected by the First Amendment because they were professionals. And it just shows that there's no limit to that, that fundamentally what that exception was just an exception for people who got paid to speak. And so we filed a brief saying, look, this is an incoherent doctrine. It has no footing in your cases. And it's gone way beyond. It's not just us saying, look at the parade of horrible things that will happen if you do this. It's look at the parade of horrible things that have actually already happened in the jurisdictions that have this rule. Don't do that. And when the opinion came down, again, it didn't cite IJ's brief directly, but it had a discussion about how far off the rails lower courts had gone with this exception, pointing specifically to this Fourth Circuit case about fortune tellers.
Which did not appear. There were many amicus briefs in that case because it was kind of a high profile culture war issue. But the fortune teller discussion didn't appear in any of those other amicus briefs. So that's one of the ways that we can know that our brief had an impact on the case.
Oh, actually, several people outside of IJ, when that opinion came down, congratulated me personally, even though like we are not in the opinion, IJ's name doesn't appear. But several people were just like, oh, Justice Thomas picked up your fortune teller thing, because we'd been beating that drum for so long. It was so clearly our argument that it was instantly recognizable to people who knew the area. They're just like, oh, the Supreme Court noticed you and you persuaded someone with that.
Was it in that case at the Supreme Court that they also referenced one of our occupational speech cases? Was it the Rosemond case the newspaper columnists.
So that's not in the opinion, but a lot of the...
Or in the oral argument?
Yeah, so in another way, you can kind of see your impact, and this is... I'm glad you reminded me of this. So our Parade of Horribles and the kind of the ways the lower courts had gone...
Are our clients.
Are frequently our clients. Yeah. Like, one of the reasons IJ generates these cases is to create these kind of, you know, very viscerally appealing and mentally sticky situations. And one of them was a case Paul did in Kentucky on behalf of John Rosemond, who was a parenting advice columnist who was sent a cease and desist letter from the state of Kentucky. He didn't live in Kentucky. He didn't do anything in Kentucky, but his newspaper column was syndicated in Kentucky, and the state of Kentucky took the position that he was engaged in the practice of psychology, because in kind of his Dear Abby-style column, he gave parenting advice, and it was published in a newspaper in Kentucky. And in that case, the state took the position that this is professional speech. There's an exception to the First Amendment for professional speech. And at oral argument, the Assistant Solicitor General of the United States was arguing the case and was asked from the bench, what are the limits to the professional speech doctrine? Does it extend to a parenting advice column? And there's exactly one parenting advice column in the history of the country that's been the subject of an occupational speech case. And the Assistant Solicitor General instantly said, no, 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 nothing like that. And he was advocating for actually an exception to the First Amendment, but he wanted it to be much more narrow than any of the lower courts had actually adopted. And that's because IJ had managed to kind of ace out that part of the field. And so you frequently see questions from the bench that don't show up in the opinions that you can tell are molded by amicus briefs. For example, there was a case several years ago called Armor v. City of Indianapolis, where there's a continuing problem in IJ's economic liberty cases, which are governed by the rational basis test. And there's a question of what it means for a law to have a rational basis. If the government can't articulate a rational basis, should a judge make up a reason the law exists, just kind of help the government over the finish line? Or is the judge stuck with what the government has actually advocated? And we say, of course, judges should be neutral. They shouldn't be making things up. And the Indiana Supreme Court had made a decision in this case where it expressly made something up. It was a case where the city of Indianapolis had adopted a way to pay for a new sewer where people could either pay on they could pay an upfront sum, or they could pay over the course of 30 years, a little bit every year. And 1 year into this program, they decided, nah, we're just going to fund this through tax revenue. We're going to forgive the remaining 29 years of payments and everyone on the installment plan, and everyone who paid upfront, we're keeping your money. And when the case got to the Indiana Supreme Court, they upheld it on kind of two grounds, one actually presented by the government, but then they said, and maybe this is just a way to help poor people. Maybe the people who are paying on the installment plan are poorer. And there's nothing in the record about that. No one said anything about that.
Zero evidence.
And so it's a sewer taxes are not IJ's kind of raison d'etre, but that legal issue is something we know a lot about. And so we filed a brief, the only brief directed at that topic, just about whether courts can actually make something up. And at oral argument,
And this is oral argument at the Indiana Supreme Court?
At oral argument at the U.S. Supreme Court. The city of Indianapolis hired Paul Clement to represent it at the U.S. Supreme Court. And he was asked by Justice Alito in the middle of his presentation, what about this helping poor people rationale? Can we uphold this law on the basis that maybe it helps poor people? And Paul Clement disavowed it. An actual holding of the lower court, he said, no, we don't want you to do that. I can't defend that. And so that doesn't show up in the opinion, but it's an example of IJ's advocacy taking arguments off the table. There were two holdings in the case that the Supreme Court was reviewing. We got the people who won below to just disavow one of them and to get a question from the bench forcing them to disavow it through our advocacy. And that's really the stuff that IJ looks to when we say we've had a successful amicus brief. There are our arguments getting into the opinion. There are our arguments showing up at oral argument. There are cases showing up at oral argument as examples. We want to affect the court concretely. We want to affect the process of the litigation and to affect the outcome. And we can't always do that. You can't guarantee that your brief is going to have that effect. But that's the desired impact, and it's not a success unless we do that.
Of course, sometimes we do get the extra credit, and it really is a great honor when courts do it, of specifically highlighting our briefs in their opinions. And this actually happened in a recent case in Texas where the issue was about due process. The government had sent a woman a letter. They had taken some adverse action against her. And they said, if you want to appeal this, here's what you have to do. And they cited their own regulation. As it turned out, both the regulation and the letter were completely misleading, and there was another step she needed to do. And because she didn't do that, she was deprived of the opportunity to appeal. And so we wrote an amicus brief saying, this violates due process. People are, you know, there's this idea that people are presumed to know the law. And we argued that if the government affirmatively misleads you, you're not expected to know more about the law than the government is expected to know. And the court actually found our arguments useful and in its brief said, you know, the Institute for Justice makes the following arguments. So that's
And we prevail. Our arguments prevailed.
And they did. And they did.
Those are the good citations.
Those are the justice
says this and is right. Is it before you want to hear it?
Yep.
And sanity prevailed.
That is one of
the most outrageous cases.
Completely outrageous. But, you know, not only did sanity prevail, it is, you know, it's always gratifying to see that kind of credit.
Yeah. So on that note, I wanted to ask sort of a personal question, because obviously you have a deep stake in things like our occupational speech litigation and the rational basis litigation. You know, with respect to amicus briefs, were there, just for you personally, one that you filed that's kind of your favorite, that it gave you a chance to work out a theory that you were thinking about, or where the case was so outrageous that you just felt grateful for the opportunity to be on the side of sanity and bring them around?
I certainly think in the occupational speech cases where we've filed briefs, Bob and I have both found that very gratifying, because we know we're having a real tangible impact on the law and it has driven the courts. The most fun that I've had writing an amicus brief was for a case called McCutcheon versus Federal Election Commission, which was about what are called the biennial aggregate contribution limits. And
sounds like a lot of fun.
I'm not going to bore our readers with
not it, but, that nerdy, Paul.
Yeah, no.
Ceiling.
Yeah, campaign finance is too nerdy, even for IJ fans. So one of the issues in campaign finance law is, when can you limit political contributions? And what the court has said since the 1970s is you can do it to prevent corruption or the appearance of corruption. And the corruption thing, everyone kind of understands what corruption is. It's bribery. It's things like that. But the appearance of corruption has proven to be this extremely amorphous term. And it's given essentially the government a free pass when it wants to enact campaign finance laws. So I wrote a brief where I kind of deconstructed what this idea of the appearance of corruption is and made the argument that essentially what it is it's saying we have to regulate private political activity because it makes people distrustful of the government. And the argument I present is, what's wrong with being distrustful of the government? We have a long history of distrust of the government. And you know, the government shouldn't be allowed to tamp down on private speech simply to control its own public relations. So that was a really fun brief to write, because it was sort of a theory that I constructed. And I also got to throw in a bunch of great historical citations to ancient admonitions about not being too trusting of the government.
So,
it's a very libertarian brief.
Yes, it was. It was.
Well, and even that kind of ties to a case that we're currently doing with the SEC, the idea that the government can't tamp down on speech in order to protect its image.
That's the thing the government quintessentially can't do. The whole point to having free speech is to allow people to criticize the government. And so the government can't silence speech solely for the purpose of protecting its reputation. So there are briefs that are fun to write. My favorite, at least recently, outside of occupational speech, has probably been an eminent domain amicus brief we did in New Jersey. Frequently when you write an amicus brief, you kind of send it into the court and then you're just outside the process. But sometimes IJ is actually invited to come to oral argument and participate in oral argument as an amicus curiae, kind of going back to the traditional Roman law sense of amicus curiae. You show up and are just a friend of the court to explain things.
Is that really rare? It seems like that wouldn't happen very often.
It is. I think it's very unusual as a general proposition. IJ has done it 3 times in the past year, so it's starting to feel common. We've argued just in the past year, we've argued as amicus at the Colorado Supreme Court, at the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and in this case in New Jersey. But part of that is that IJ's briefs, particularly in state courts, really do bring a national perspective that I think a lot of courts can find useful. And what happened in the New Jersey case is, you know, we obviously have been litigating for years our Atlantic City case on behalf of Charlie Birnbaum, and we've been litigating eminent domain all across the country. And so we just have this enormous well of expertise, and we were able to provide a brief to the court that didn't just provide a few useful cases, but where we could actually come in and say, here is how this works in all 50 states. I've looked at all 50 states. Here's the governing law. And, you know, here's how most states do it. Here's how Nevada does it, which is a little unusual. And here's the way to be most protective of property rights as you're reading New Jersey's law. And I actually had to go up to New Jersey to argue the case, despite not having any clients in the case or any real skin in the game, just kind of on the grounds of IJ's own expertise. And it was it's fun. It's always fun to be in court. It's fun to be in court for the sole purpose of being helpful. And it was gratifying there because, you know, frequently what we do is try to find strong cases from outside the state and bring them inside the state and say, here, you should do this. And not only did that court rule for the property owners and throw out the condemnation, but it actually did so citing some of my favorite cases from across the country. And so those cases that I really like are now the law in New Jersey. I've kind of managed to import them, and now New Jersey property owners can enjoy the same protections that people in other states have enjoyed, just because IJ can go out and find those cases and bring them to judges in your state and say, this is a good rule. You should follow this rule. This is more protective. And once the court cites that, it sort of imports it into New Jersey law and lets you in one fell swoop really improve things for property owners there by importing what local practitioners frequently don't even know they can talk about. They don't follow the law in Indiana or the law in Utah. And we do, and we can kind of bring that perspective and encourage courts to choose the right path.
So for that local practitioner, are they usually, in the instances where it has happened that we've been able to come in and have some argument time, how do they react? Because it seems like they could either be grateful to have the help, the support, the reputation that IJ is able to bring, or they might be a little bit territorial. Have you seen both? Do you tend to see one more than the other?
I would say generally people are pretty favorable to us coming in as long as we're coming in
to help
on their side. Now, one counterexample is the case that our colleague Josh Windham recently argued in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, where this was a zoning dispute between a city and this gentleman who owned a house that he was renting out as an Airbnb. The city cited him, and a lower court had said, no, this doesn't violate the zoning code. Well, as the case was going forward, the property owner sold the house. The city still had an interest in the case going forward because they'd been told that they couldn't cite people for this thing. So they wanted a resolution. And so our colleague found this case and he wrote a brief about this doctrine of strict construction, that when you're interpreting zoning codes that restrict people's use of property, you have to interpret them narrowly to allow the maximum use of the property. The guy who owned the property wasn't happy that we were getting involved in the case because he had essentially a victory below, and he was hoping the court would just dismiss the case. But we thought it was important that the court be presented with these arguments. And ultimately, since we were the only ones who showed up, Josh was allowed to argue the case, and he did a fantastic job.
Wonderful. Well, we're out of time. It concludes our show for today. Bob, Paul, thank you so much for joining. Thanks to all our listeners, and of course to IJ supporters who make this all possible. If you enjoy getting this kind of in-depth content on IJ's work, don't forget to follow us and to subscribe.